Hello everyone, welcome to Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends, the podcast where I speak to people much more interesting than myself. Please enjoy. Hello everyone and welcome to this edition of Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends, the podcast where I talk to people a lot more interesting than myself, as the intro which I put in front of this will tell you. I'm joined today by, a man who's got dirtier blues than a mucky Rangers kit. It's all the way from Lurgan, Mr. Andy McGibbon from the Bonnevilles.
Hello, Andy. Hiya, Darren. How's it going?
I'm dead on, buddy. You're live in your recording studio / locked at the bottom of the garden, eh?
Yeah, that's it. Yep, that's exactly where I am.
Very cool. How is life treating you down by the shores of Loch Ness? Having fun?
Absolutely brilliant. Love it. Lockdown is a joy. Long may it continue.
Well, one of the things is as well, obviously because you play in an international touring band, there is no international and there's very little touring. How are you coping?
Yeah.
Are you...
Pretty shit, actually. I'll be honest with you. The band is dead on its fucking ass, and we just it sucks. We did a couple of live streams on Facebook. We've done 3 or 4 or 5 of them now. I enjoy them. They're pretty fun. The last one was the best one, I think, because we were able to bring one or two of our friends into the studio, into the house actually, and they were able. So I was able to interact with them and have a bit of an audience, and it was I give it a bit of the beans, you know, and I really enjoyed that one. But it just made me realise how much I'm desperate in need of attention, and I need the love of strangers in foreign countries.
Andy, you're talking to a comedian who tours, you know what I mean? I know all about this.
Yes, exactly.
Like I know my family love me and I know my mother loves me, but that's no good to me. I need roomfuls of strangers to love me.
Exactly the same. It's fucking pathetic. Yeah. But there you go.
Whatever.
It's made me realize how pathetic I really am, and I'm very comfortable with that.
I'm exactly the same. I'm full on middle child syndrome, so it's okay. I've actually wanted to get you on for a while because I really do enjoy your podcast, which is what's the correct term? Is it Andy? What's in the Bonnevilles? Andy, that's in the Bonnevilles. What's your podcast?
Andy, that's in the Bonnevilles.
That's in the Bonnevilles. Yeah. Sorry, I was obviously paraphrasing that as, you know, how eloquently people from Lurgan speak. So
yeah. Either or, I don't mind.
Yeah. By the way, don't take any shit off me. I'm from outside Newry, so there's no room for slagging whatsoever. I'm also an Armagh man myself, so it's not too bad.
That's all good.
Yeah. But you do solo stuff as well. Has this given you a chance to work on anything? Or I know you were saying before we started recording, you're producing something at the minute.
Yeah, well, I'm working on this wee project for a wee Irish language group that I'm involved with here in Lurgan at the St. Peter's GA Club. But that's just a wee side project. But yeah, I have a solo album that, that was why I built this studio. In fact, I came off a tour about 2 years ago, and I was absolutely direct. Chris and I had done, I can't remember exactly, but it was like 5 tours in 4 months or something, and one of them was 3 weeks long, and it was all over Europe, well over the East Europe, and we worked it out that we drove on average for 9 hours a day, and when I came off that, I was just drained, physically, emotionally drained. And I sort of got myself into a place where I was in danger of quitting, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
But I didn't, obviously I don't want to quit, but I wasn't feeling motivated to move on, to carry on. And so what I did was I gave myself a challenge, let me put it that way. So what I decided to do was build a studio and record an album and everything on it from the ground up, literally. And so I've done that. And I used it as an opportunity to stretch my songwriting muscle and try and write from a new place to hopefully, the thought at the time for me was to try and reinvigorate my passion for what I'm doing by coming at it from a new angle. And it worked. It worked. And I believe I'm a great believer in listening to your gut, you know, and that instinct that you have in the back of your head. And I think that's what it was. I think it was my gut, my whatever the universe, God, or whatever it is you believe in or don't believe in, just sort of telling me, you know, you need to go and do this. So this is how you get out of this, you know.
That's pretty cool, man. I mean, obviously, as you're saying, doing tours like that around Europe, my kind of empathy for that is I used to be a roadie years ago for the Dangerfields. So I've done...
Oh, my God.
I've done a month in Europe with the boys.
With Andy?
With Andy. I came home when you would have swore I just finished my second tour in Nam. I was...
I remember watching their turn schedule and just... It would have killed a horse.
Yeah. Do you know what, though? See, when I was 21, it was the best time of my fucking life. It was so much crack.
Yeah, bound to be, yeah.
But now...
Didn't Andy do stand-up for a bit? Sorry.
Andy did stand-up for a wee bit. He's actually, at the minute, because we're waiting to see if it's possible, he wanted to do a 20th anniversary of the band, which was supposed to be in June, but has now been moved to August. But if it can't happen in August, it is going to happen this year, and I'm probably going to be down helping again. And I'm actually... Now, as Darren the comedian, not Darren the roadie, I'm going to be doing intros, introducing the bands in between.
Brilliant. So, brilliant.
Yeah, 20th anniversary of the Dangerfields. They've had more members than the IRA. They're good lads. So,
yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, the SS Dangerfields, God bless her and all who's sailing her. You know what I mean? It's fucking madness. Yeah, we did Europe in a van. With a band from Holland called the Accelerators, and I also did two UK tours with them when they were opening act on the 30th anniversary for Stiff Little Fingers. They were doing a 30th anniversary tour, which was great. So I got to work in like a punk squat in Leipzig in Germany, and then I also got to work in the Ulster Hall. So it's fucking weird.
That's touring, yeah. Man. That's the way it is.
Yeah. I know, but I'm sure that's one of the things I wanted to get you on about, to definitely talk about touring is. And it happens in comedy as well. The inconsistencies of venues and shows. Do you ever do that? When you do 200 people on a Friday night in Germany, and then on Monday you're doing 14 people in Denmark. You know what I mean?
It's unbelievable, and it is, as you say, it's a part of the business, and you have to deal with it, and you have to learn how to deal with it. And I tell you where I got because you know when you start out. It is a bit of a kick it's a bit of a kick to the ego, and you literally have to figure out mentally how do you deal with that. And I'm not given to quoting Police, you know, the band Police, Sting, and but I remember I read in a Mojo magazine years ago, and he was asked about how they broke America, and he told the story of when the Police first went to America. So they were kind of a big deal in the burgeoning UK punk scene, late 70s, early 80s. But then they went a bit more commercial, and they got picked up by their American label, and they got brought over, and they were literally that band playing to two men and a dog. And they were filled on top of the pops in the UK and two men and a dog in the US. And Sting just says you have to play every show like it's packed, like it's, you have to give it your all for every concert you play. And at one of those shows, there was a person who ended up becoming their manager and broke them in America.
So you never know who's there. Is that what you're kind of saying?
Well, that was kind of the icing, the cherry on the cake for him, I guess. But I mean, I'm not suffering under any illusions that I know what the Bonnevilles are. You know, they're just a big dirty blues band and garage punk blues band. That's all we do, and it's fun and it's what it is, and it's never going to go anywhere massive. So, but I'm very happy with that. I'm very content with that. It's not a problem, but it was just that. It's just, if you can get advice from people like that, you have to take it. And that's what it is. Whenever they're talking to you through a magazine, and they're, how do you deal with whenever you play to four people on a Tuesday night and 200 people on a Friday and a Saturday? You just, that's how you deal with it. You have to just do it.
Yeah.
They all had to do it, so you have to do it.
No matter who's there, give it your 100%. Don't be up there looking bored.
Exactly. And that was the odd thing as well. I remember when I started out in bands, I don't know whether it's our uniquely Northern Irishness or Irishness or something about us being from Lurgan. I don't know what it was. But bands always, they were very slow to get started, and they could come onto the stage. And I'm talking about local bands here. And they could come onto the stage and they would maybe take a few songs to kind of get warmed up to get into it and all the rest of it. And then I remember going to watch American bands up in Belfast and Aunt Annie's and things, you know. So the American garage bands like the White Stripes and the Von Bondies and the Sights and Pearlene and all these bands. And these were not the White Stripes, I'm talking about the rest of them, but these were bands that are sort of at the level that I'm at now, back then. And they didn't fuck about. They hit that stage hot and hard and fast from the minute they went on to the minute it was just a rock and roll sweat fest. And that's where I learned that from watching them. Because when I contrasted that with what all the rest of what we were doing here in Ireland, it was so much better. You know, and I was going, yeah, that's right. What are we doing? We're fucking about for 10 minutes before we get warmed up.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw and something that I learned actually from touring and from working, because one of the things I will always say about the Dangerfields is they were a really tight band, and they could play fucking 30 songs in an hour, you know, that kind of thing, because they blast the punk. But one of the great things was where I learned, and from working with bigger bands, I remember the first time that I saw a set list and there was like four songs and then a line. And I actually said to the guy, goes, what's the line for? And he went, that's when I say hello, we check our tuning, and there's like a 30-second break, because they just rattle the first four songs to grab them by the throat and keep them there.
Yeah, that's it. And it's kind of a thing as well. I mean, you have to learn how to do these things, of course, but you can learn a lot from reading or listening to interviews from people, watching documentaries. And if George Harrison's on talking about how the Beatles started, you have to fucking listen. And if you can glean a little bit of advice from that, you know, if you get it in your profession, if you're fortunate enough to get a hearing interview with Billy Connolly or Dave Chappelle, you fucking listen to it, and you're trying to suck a bit of information that you can take with you, you know. And I do that with all that stuff. But you have to get it. You have to get the opportunities to use it. And as you said, hitting them hard, with Dangerfields, hitting them hard and fast, right from the very start. It's a great way to learn that you must do that is play a festival, because you've only got about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
If you're sometimes less. If you're a headliner, you might have an hour tops. That's it. 45 minutes. And that could be you. So you don't have time to waste. There's no encore. You know what I mean? The plug's getting pulled. There's somebody waiting to come on behind you. Yeah. And if you turn up 5 minutes late, that's 5 minutes off your set time. That doesn't go on to the next guy. Do you know what I mean? And so once you play a couple of festivals and realize that you sucked, or that your set wasn't up to speed, you know, I remember Sean Duncan, who did the video. He's done a couple of videos for us. He done the video for 10,000, and he did the Good Suits and Fighting Boots video, the wrestling one.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time we played Glasgowbury, there up in the north coast, and I was getting my set together, and he gave me again a piece of advice that for me and Chris now, it's just a running standard joke. He says, will I put this song into the set? And he just said, stick to the hits.
Yeah.
That's it. Stick to the hits.
It's collectively known as a festival set.
It's collectively known as a festival set. But that's what I mean. You have to play the festival to get to learn how to do that. You got to fuck it up a couple of times. And then, you know.
Yeah, you have to find out that nobody wants to hear your 7-minute B-side. That they don't know it's not on the fucking album that they have, and you're like, why is everyone leaving and going to the bar? And like, because you're not even at the first course.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But see the problem as a musician, and I don't know about your game, maybe you could answer this, but As a musician, you always want to play the song that you're currently working on, that you're always writing. That's the new thing that you want to, that you get your biggest kick out of.
Yeah.
So you always want to do that. The fucking place that you don't do it is at a festival. You just don't.
Yeah. Get your own gig. Wait till you're not messed about. Well, one of the things about me as well is, as working as a roadie years ago, I played in bands. And one of the reasons I am a comedian is because I didn't want to play in bands anymore.
Yeah. So right, okay. Yeah.
So I played the drums, so that was what it was.
Oh yeah, okay. Oh great, okay. Right. Yeah, so you played in about 8 bands.
I did, because we were truly at the time drummers are hen's teeth. I was should have been charging more, you know what I mean?
That's the running joke with I think Chris put it up during this COVID thing. You know, we have to get the heavy metal drummers have to go into fucking hard lockdown, because if one of them dies, about 300 bands are fucked.
That's very true. No, absolutely. I remember doing gigs. I used to run shows as well in the INF down in Warren Point, and I would have ran shows in Uri as well when I was like 17, 18.
Yes.
At one point, I was playing in, I think, 3 bands, and I also ended up filling in for a mate of mine that was playing drums. So there was one gig that I ran the show and didn't leave the drum kit. I played 3 sets.
It's ridiculous.
So there was no setting up. I just had the sweat was pissing off me. And I was in the headlining band that we were supposed to do 45 minutes. And I was like, and it was a punk band. Yeah. So it's not like you're.
Yeah.
No decking about. It was fucking.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So yeah. Do you know what? I was probably in the best shape of my life when I was 18 or 19, playing Gaelic football and playing drums. That's all I was doing.
I know, isn't that the fucking truth? Did you ever play in the Dangerfields?
No, because they only have one drummer, and that's Andy, who does the singing. That's the only member that's never replaced. It's his band, right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
that's right.
No, so there was no call for me. But do you know what was weird as well? Because I ended up doing comedy, out of necessity, I learned how to do all the other stuff, because I was dealing with other musicians who they pretty much used to pop my head away, because I was quite driven and, you know, quite organized, which is why I ended up. But it got to that point where the boys saw that I was organized and started leaving shit for me to do. So I could, I taught myself how to do sound. I ended up fucking rewiring guitars. I ended up owning a full backline because I couldn't trust people to show up with their stuff.
Oh my God.
This all became necessity out of what I was doing. And then anybody who was in a band with me, they'd be like, oh, can I just use your amp? And I'm like, no, motherfucker, you can't. Because I've gone and bought that because you bastards can't fucking go on. And then people are like, oh, the stuff's so expensive. And I'm like, see that symbol that goes, shh, that's 200 quid and you can't buy fucking strings.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
There's something wrong if your drummer is rewiring your guitar before a gig. Like, I'm in the corner with a fucking solder now.
Yeah, without a doubt, there's definitely something fucking wrong with that.
Yeah.
That's really weird. I think you're probably the first drummer I've ever met that sounds organized. Any drummer I've ever worked with or met, Chris let me put it this way.
Chris is lethal. I've seen you guys play. He can fucking play like
He's lethal. He's a great drummer and a fantastic guy. But every drummer, I don't know too many drummers that actually own a car. You know, things like that.
I never got that. I never understood that. Just like there was a time when I was playing drums and I didn't have a car, but fuck me.
Yeah.
And a car big enough to put a kid into.
Well, I used to play in a band, and a guy bought a kid. It was a blues cover band thing. He bought a new car. And which is a drummer thing to do. If you do buy a car, you bring the case of the bass drum to make sure you can get it in the back, right? Well, he did that, but he bought the car and it was literally only big enough for him and the drum kit. And I said, well, why did you not just get a bigger car and then we don't have to take 2 cars to the gig?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, well, fuck you. I don't care about you. He's going to do whatever he wants. Yeah, you're not coming with me.
Yeah, no, that's no good. This is the arguments that bands break up over. Is it one of the things as well? I mean, like all sort of at that point where let's talk about some great duos, because you're doing the Bonnevilles as a duo. So let's talk about some great duos. We got stuff like people who are have gone on to good things. So stuff like the Black Keys, stuff like the White Stripes, Bross. Mm-hmm. They were another great duo.
Did you see that documentary?
I did, actually. That he was crazy. We're fucking nuts.
Brilliant. I mean, it's fucking bros. I remember I used to play in a wee band when I was at school, and Bros had just came out. We were doing Smith's covers. That's what kind of what we were trying to do.
You were the cool kids, were
you? Well, I wasn't there. I don't know what I was. But we were doing Smith's covers, and I went into the rehearsal. Bros had just come out, and their first song was called When Will I Be Famous?
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, and I came into the rehearsal room, which was St. Anthony's Hall, St. Anthony's Parish Hall out in Craigavon. And I says, here, why don't we do a cover of that song, Bros? Why do you hear? And the fuck, honestly, if they could have gotten someone else to do what I was doing as badly as I did it, they'd have threw me out.
Yeah. Folks, as well, I should point out to you, if you're under about the age of 34, sorry for that reference, go and Google them. Bros were a thing. One of them actually ended up being the bad guy in Blade 2. Fun fact.
That's right. And Hellboy.
You are correct as well. He's in Hellboy as well. Have a check. But what made you decide? I mean, obviously for years you've played in bands in the most conventional sense. What made you decide that you needed a challenge where you had to be guitar player, singer, with also leaving in heaviness and bass? And like, you're fucking busy in that band. You're not a guitar player. You're not a singer. You're everybody at once. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, with I started the two piece thing, with another. Well, it was actually another guy started it, and he asked me to do it, and I wasn't convinced that it was a thing that I wanted to do or was capable of doing. But he was, and we kind of got a few gigs. We went over to London, and we did a wee tour in Belgium and Holland and all. But we kind of fell out. But just as we were falling out, I was kind of starting to feel comfortable with this two-piece thing. And I'd written probably about a third to a half of our first of the Bonnevilles' first album, what would become the Bonnevilles' first album. And I read a chunk of that already done. So I was kind of going, I don't know if I really want to quit this, but I can't play with him anymore. So I have to give him credit. You know, it was him going, no, you can do this and we can do this. He was right about one of those things. So I started to ask other guys to come in and do the drumming bit. And I went through two or three guys before I asked Chris. And it was just kind of, the White Stripes had happened. The Black Keys were about to happen. I was a huge blues fan, so two-piece blues bands from back in the day, is not uncommon. Yep. There's loads of that going on in the blues world. Although the blues world had gotten very, as I keep calling it, sort of all 80s and cooked up. It was all about sort of pub blues. And I be honest with you, I don't like that at all. It's not for me. I'm not slagging it off. I'm not saying that it's just not for me. So that was where I got to. I love bands like Soundgarden, and they came through the whole grunge thing as well. Yeah, exactly. And so that sort of heaviness, but with a bit of, with melody and lyrics and all that, that's what I like. So the two just kind of mesh together. And the two-piece thing, there's a very practical aspect to that. You were a roadie in a band with three or four members, and you, me and Chris, for a start, we say yes to everything. We want to do it. We've turned nothing down. And that's it. If we brought in, I would love a keyboard player, big organ sound, I would love that. But unless we would be in danger of fucking what we have up. By bringing in another member.
What you can hopefully do is do what a lot of bands do, which is, like, I'm a massive Green Day fan. I have been since I was a kid. And when you go see them, so I remember seeing them years ago, and there was just three of them. When you go see them live now, Billy Joe Armstrong barely plays his fucking guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of clapping, and you're just like, who's playing guitar? And there's a guy over, side stage looking at him, going, "What song are we playing?"
Really?
Yeah, Stereophonics are the same. They have a guy at the back filling up. He's like filling out the sound. I've seen a few bands do that now, but they're bigger bands. You know, wait till you get to the bigger, level, sort of thing. So,
Green Day have
a guy who plays accordion. They've got a guy called Jason Freeze. He's actually Josh Freeze. You know, Josh Freeze, the drummer, plays for a Perfect Circle and Vandals.
Yeah.
His brother, he plays for Green Day, and he's a multi-instrumentalist, very talented dude. But it's all to fill out the sound. It's all to make it that big stadium sound, you know?
Oh, where it's going
for a fully stripped back, how dirty can
we? Yeah, yeah, that's it. So, yeah, it's I don't know. What, I mean, I'll be honest with you. There wasn't really a lot of me. You know, I don't remember sitting down at any point and going, okay, this is what I want the sound like, or this is what I just... It's kind of that thing that necessity is the mother of invention. You're just out there doing a thing and you go, okay, I need to play this with a bit, you know, the bass line needs fattened up, so we'll go and find an amp that makes that work. And then, you know, stuff like that. It's just working your way through it, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to say from listening to the Bonnevilles, I do like your stuff on it because I play it in bands and I've recorded and stuff. Yeah. I can hear how you're doing certain things. I don't want this to sound like it's a bad thing, but your recordings, there's that sound because it's the blues. You've kind of made it sound like it's from further back. It doesn't have that digital clean bullshit about it. It's very, there's a lot of room mic. There's a lot of openness. There's a lot of space in it. Was that something you decided to do? Or were you like, I want this to sound like the stuff I grew up listening to?
Oh, that, yeah, all that. The second one, definitely. I recorded it on the tape. I got a tape machine and I'd never recorded an album in my life, and I just figured out how to do it, and bootleg software and all this sort of stuff, you know, and recorded it on the tape, digitized that tape and, you know, into an old version of Cubase back 10 years ago, and sort of muddled my way through that. But one of the things that I've come to realize with especially with recording is when you go, like, you know yourself, if there's anything you want to learn how to do, you can go onto YouTube. Somebody's made a YouTube video, right? So, like, back in the day, it wasn't, but maybe 10 years ago, it just wasn't as easy come by as it is now. But you could still find stuff with someone giving you advice. You know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And you could go find blogs and all this sort of thing. And I've come to completely disagree with it. People are very definitive about how to do a thing. So they say, you cannot do this or you mustn't do that. And I'm going, but I like the way that sounds. You know, so, and if you listen to that, then you're going to end up disappointed. You need to trust your own ears. You need to go, that's the thing that I've done. I like the way we got picked up a publishing deal years ago, and the publisher says, you're going to have to go and re-record that first album because it sounds like shit. And I said, I'm not recording. He says, well, give me the tapes and I'll go bring them down to a professional studio down in Dublin and we'll get it remixed. And I says, well, sure, okay. And then about two or three days later, he says, have you got me those tapes? And I had them in a shoebox in the attic, and I went up into the attic and took the shoebox out the garden and burnt them, so that there was absolutely no fucking way that album was getting remixed, because it's sacrilege. You can't do that. Just in case the temptation, if I got offered money or anything, not that I was ever, that was ever in danger of happening, but I'm always ready to be offered money if anybody wanted to offer it. But I was just sort of alert to that. Maybe he might wear me down, and I might give him the tapes. So I destroyed them so that couldn't happen. And the sound. So then, whenever we go, so that's the first album. So then, with the second, and the third, and the fourth albums, then we had to go and find us an engineer that could get our sound, that could understand what it was we were trying to do. And we've been very, very lucky that we found, on our second album, a guy called Walter Dagoon from Dublin, who had a studio in Belfast. And then we've got Michael Marmica, who now is a studio in Ballinderry, but he's moved it now to Hillsborough. and it's that, and he gets us, he knows what we want.
Yeah, and Mike's old band Mojo Fury, they loved a bit of dirt as well. And I used to book them. I know them. He's a good dude as well.
Yeah, there you go. You know who I'm talking about. So yeah. Mike was a fan of the Bonnevilles, and he would come and see us, and we became friends. And then whenever Walter closed the studio, we were going to do our third album in with Walter, but he closed the studio. He got a job with the BBC, and he went and did that. So we were left. He did offer to record it, but we kind of wanted the studio thing. They wanted to go into a studio and do it that way. And Mike had always said, listen, if you ever need me for anything, give me a shout. And we just said, yeah, he's going to get us. Mike knows what we want. So
yeah, he knows the aspect of trying to capture. The great thing with bands like yourself is, how do we translate the joy and the energy of live onto this piece of hardware? And that's hard to do. Yeah.
You know, very. I mean,
you're probably a band that belongs on vinyl with some old speakers, you know, that kind of thing. There's a way to listen to the Bonnevilles. It's not a digitally encoded MP3 that's been crushed and put on Spotify. It has to be get a nice warm vinyl, sit in a room, open a beer, and just get the dirt. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. That's what I enjoy. I mean, I enjoy that of other bands, you know, and you know, even today, you know, American music is the thing that has always influenced me, really. But I found a band on, well, I know who they are. There's a band called the Orwells. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. Yeah. But they've been going around since about 2012. And they're absolutely brilliant. And I'd heard them before, and I'd forgot about them. And then just the other day, I'd sort of rediscovered them again, you know what I mean? And I started to listen to them. It was just on Spotify. And they just got that glorious American garage punk sound, that raw thing.
Like and Stooges, then MC5, all that kind of just dirty.
Exactly that. And it was really weird because it was on a little playlist that I have for when I'm working out. And the Orwells played, and then the next song that followed them was the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and it was a song from Blood Sugar Sex Magik album back in it, when they made that in 1940 fucking stand. And
Sugar Sex Magik was 91, I think, but okay.
Yeah. But the two songs, by contrast, next to each other, were so fucking different. It was unbelievable that the Orwells had that raw garage thing that I particularly enjoy. And I like, although I did like Red Hot Chili Peppers back in the day, yeah. But their sound was that Californian clean sound that is very very processed and it's great, and it's great that they do, and it's fantastic. But you just see the two back to back couldn't. It was literally yin and yang, completely different sounds, you know.
I think one of the aspects from when I used to play as well, and I listen to a lot of older music. Like I really love what is now deemed classic rock. And even then, I really love old stuff like Americana stuff. I mean, even if you talk about bands playing live and recording stuff together, and I'm a real romantic for reading books and autobiographies about bands and musicians about how they recorded albums. Stuff like, you know, Deep Purple recording in hotel hallways in Switzerland, the Rolling Stones recording in a fucking wine cellar in France. I love all that sort of shit. I think that's really nice stories. Whereas when I was in a band, we were just paying to go to a studio. But there was none of that love. There was no story in it. We weren't going to have that romantic tale at the end. That's part of what I love about music is all that kind of stuff. I really like stuff like when you see documentaries about guys like Tom Petty, or even that. If you want to be a bit more commercial, Sound City, which was the documentary Dave Grohl made.
Yeah.
Which was phenomenal. Oh my God, the albums that were made on that desk alone. Of course he bought it. There should have been a bid war over that.
They were going to throw in the bin.
Yeah. So pretty much, if anybody hasn't seen the thing, go and listen to, go and find some of your top 10 albums, and probably 3 or 4 of them have been recorded in the same studio, which was Sound City in Los Angeles, which was a shithole. But it's the same place where Nirvana recorded Nevermind, and what, Fleetwood Mac did Rumours? Wasn't that the same
desk? Yeah.
Did everything?
Yeah. Yeah.
Music is missing some of that romanticism of. And maybe that's an analog thing. I love old, you know what I mean? I love, and even stuff that people listen to it now and go, oh, that sounds fucking horrible. I'm like, but I love Minor Threat Husker Du.
Yeah.
The Replacements. Because it sounds so fucking cool. And the other thing as well is those guys weren't hiding behind any digital. If you could fucking play, you could fucking play. There was no, there's no Pro Tools. There's no tuning you. There's no, I'll do that again and I'll edit that guitar scratch. I love hearing stuff like that that's not used in music. And one of the things, I was chatting to my mate about stuff. This was actually years ago. I was chatting to Dave McGee, who used to be in LaFaro.
Uh-huh. Oh, Dave, yeah.
And we were saying about stuff that doesn't get used anymore. And I was like, things that don't get used anymore that should be used. Guitar pick slides. Why? They're so good.
Brilliant.
You know, bringing you back into that last course of, meow, bam.
Yeah.
And I said another thing, two other things that don't get used. Number one, fade outs. When a song used to fade, it didn't end. It would fuck off into the distance.
I still do that. I still fade out. I have three songs on my solo albums all fading out.
Do you know what else we talked about as well? Stuff that we miss is whenever somebody hides a wee riff in a fade out, like it's not in any other part of the song, but maybe when they're recording, somebody's just noodling a bit because they're like, oh, and it makes the record.
It makes the record. In the fade out.
Yeah, only in the fade out though. Nowhere else.
Fantastic. I love that. I fucking, there's like, I've got a song on my new album. It's called A Winter Song. And it's got a real kind of groovy 60s vibe, very reverb heavy and all that sort of stuff. A wee acoustic thing. And I left a mistake in at the start. So I start to play the song and I strum and I make a mistake and I stop and I go, okay, do that again. Now, I'm talking to myself. There's no one in the studio. It's my studio. I'm here on my own. But I'm just saying do it again for whenever I'm listening back so that I know what the fuck's going on. If I listen to, you know, if I come back to it tomorrow, I know what's going on. I go, okay, do that again. And then I count in with the guitar. One, two, you know, reckon the strings as a 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, exactly that. And that's the start of the song. And then all the, you know, the bass and the drums and everything all come in on the five. And it's just that wee mistake gets left in. But those things, I agree with you, those things for me are just colour.
Yeah.
And they make a more interesting listening experience. And for me, like yourself, you know, you come up through the punk thing. I came up through the blues thing. And I can hear, my favourite blues records are littered with mistakes. Littered with them. Well, I wouldn't call them mistakes. They're just musicians. They're not machines. And you get it down and you go, how did it feel? It felt good. How did it feel to you? It felt good. Right, that's it. Leave it in. John Lee Hooker didn't even know what four was. He would just go off on one. This musicians had to try and figure out what he was doing. And those things would go on his big, like Boom Boom, his biggest record. Technically, it's a fucking disaster. But it felt right and it was a good take. So that's the fucking thing that they use. And I love that.
I think it'd be great to be playing with somebody like John Lee Hooker back in the day and going, John, how many bars is that? And he's just like, no, we're just going to go to the one bar, have a couple of drinks. Like, no.
Exactly. Next, I don't know if you know that about him. You probably do. But anybody listening, the next time you're listening to a John Hooker, or go and have a listen to a John Hooker album, and you will hear him go into a key change and the band trying to get there with them a beat later, always late, because he just decided to do it and didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
You know?
I was listening to something the other day. It was Husker Du, Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely, with Bob Mould was the singer-songwriter in that one. And when you listen to it, he obviously recorded it with the whole band playing, but there's a bit where it's so fucking sloppy, but it's so good. You know what I mean? It's just like, this is a mess. And I remember actually the first time, because I was playing in bands when I was younger, and the first time I went to a recording studio, they were like, so we're going to use a click track. And I went, what's a click track? I mean, this is stuff that catches you. And thank God I was in a punk band, so we were able to excuse it and be like, well, we all just play together. Can we not just record everything together and then overdub the vocals? Because we couldn't play for shit anyway, so we might as well do it collectively.
You might as well collectively play shit. Yeah. Exactly. And the click track, playing that click track is just something that you can just do. It's not, you need to train yourself to do it.
Oh, fuck, you cannot. It's the,
if you're not used to it, you can't do it.
Yeah, you need to. Actually, the next time I was going into a studio then, my mate had like a little portable click and I sat for ages just learning 4-4. It was like relearning drums. playing again and trying to, you know, how to do the role that you know goes in the song, and then going, that doesn't actually fit the timing. The boys are just following me. So it's like, oh shit, I have to rewrite this. And then we go back to the practice room, and the guys are like, why are you playing that differently? I'm like, because we can't record it this way.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it, man. That's it.
But actually, one of my favorite, something that's on a massive album, which is a mistake, is Polly by Nirvana.
Yeah.
He comes in early on the second verse, and Butch Vig just went, we'll leave it in.
Did he?
He goes, Polly says, and then it stops, and then he goes, Polly says her back hurts. That's a fuck up. And they just left it on the tape.
I like that. I'm okay with that shit. I'm okay with that.
See, this is why I wanted you on, because I look like a neurotic mess when I'm like, all these little nerdy things that I know about music that I fucking loved, because like, I grew up in Bessbrook and Armagh. There's a lot of time to sit in your room and listen to fucking music and stuff that I think is missing from modern music. Like, it's really cool. I think it's nice you guys are releasing on vinyl, which has now become the fucking trendy thing to do. But do you remember the greatness of sitting in your room and reading liner notes and reading booklets?
Mate, one of the great joys in life is reading. I'll be honest with you, reading sleeve notes for me helped me create my world map in my head, because you start to see a producer's name getting repeated, and this studio was used, and you know, it's obviously you couldn't just Google this stuff. So it was from reading magazines, and you would glean a little bit of information, and you go, oh, that's the same. And you would start to make this star map of the fucking world of music that you're interested in. You start to realize that guy's connected to him, and that label's connected to that studio, and you make all this, and you get that from reading sleeve notes. And there's nothing you didn't read on a sleeve note. It wasn't just the fucking lyrics. It was, if the artist had wrote a little thing on the that you could read it, you know, that they said it was. So it wasn't just lyrics. It was, you know, this is what the guy said, and he tells you about how the album came to be. Ah, fucking joy of joys.
My favorite thing to do as well from that was, especially in the punk world, which is where I grew up, I listened to a lot of stuff like NoFX, Bad Religion. One of the great things all those bands used to do, because punk bands traditionally would have played in like smaller clubs, they were always on tour. Their new album would always have a thank you list of bands they had toured with. And then I would be like, who the fuck's that band? And I would go see a new band. It was brilliant. Bands they thank. And you just get into that. Well, who the fuck are they? Oh, they're on that label as well. I must go check out that. And mates of mine, we would just be trading CDs, being like, I have that album. You're like, oh, fuck, can I have that?
Yeah, brilliant. Well, one of the things I'm doing with my new album is I'm not going to be able to get very fancy with the sleeve notes with the labels copies, because it's only a small label, and, you know, printing costs are expensive, so they try to keep their costs down, whatever. But what I'm doing at my end, so I'll have a few hundred copies here for me to sell or whatever. I'm going to make a booklet myself. So I'm going to make like a limited edition screen printed booklet of the story of the album, like 8 or 10 pages, you know, to put into my copies of the album that I'm going to sell. So it's a good sleeve note experience, you know, and it'll all be limited edition and numbered and all that.
I like that, Matt. Bands that are very good for that kind of stuff. So including extra stuff on albums. And it's my mate, Tommy Daly, it's his favorite band ever, and he's got a lot of the vinyl. A band that's great for that, of including extra stuff and wee box sets and bits and bobs, are the Manic Street Preachers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of art, and there's a lot of, I mean, their album Journal for Plague Lovers was Richie Edwards' journals. And they reprinted that, and it was included with the album, which is so fucking cool, because they used the lyrics basically of, well, he's now legally dead, and wrote an album from that where they got his, James Dean Bradfield took his, like, that's another thing I love about music, is just it's all the romanticism, I suppose, of like their mate wrote an album without realizing it. They were able to make an album from his.
That's wonderful.
Musings and his thing. That's how cool is that? You know what I mean?
It is. It's absolutely fantastic, and it is a thing that I understand that, you know, why labels don't do it. It's one of those things, because I'm old enough, and I come from the era that understands that an album is a piece of art.
Absolutely.
And that you get to have your input into the piece of art. You know, a band like Pink Floyd you know, what they did with their fucking album art was, you know, you could hang that stuff in a museum. And that's where it filters through. And that's one of the things that I love about the grunge scene as well. The grunge, but when I come through with the grunge scene, they got that. Everything was arty. It tried to be artistic as possible. It tried to make every moment say something or mean something or do a thing. And
that's your old Sub Pop bands and stuff, the Seattle scene.
I loved all that. I loved all that. Pardon me. Soundgarden is my favorite band of all time. But, you know, I enjoyed Pearl Jam and everybody else. I remember we were going to see the Pixies back in the day as well and all those sorts of bands. But, yeah. Yeah, album art, can't beat it.
I saw the Pixies when I used to live in Canada, and I went to a thing a couple of years called the Rockfest, which was in Montebello in Quebec, which is this little village. It's about the size of Bessbrook, where I'm from, population like 900. But once a year when this festival's on, it goes up to 200,000.
Oh my God.
It's a festival. That's what they had. I went 2 years in a row. The second year I went, what do you hear this for a lineup of three bands? I saw the Pixies headline the second stage. So they headlined, and it was so artistic what they did. They were backlit, so you couldn't see the band. You could just see shadows playing. They're so
very
so Pixies artsy.
Thing to do. Yeah,
very Pixies thing to do. So but it was so funny because they went on after Ice Cube, and before that was Twisted Sister's last ever Canadian show.
Fuck me, Ice Cube and Twisted Sister.
How good is that?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
That's and really, really good.
Who was it? Twisted Sister had a guest drummer. They had Mike Portnoy because the reason they called it a day was because their drummer had passed away the year before from cancer. So as someone who grew up playing drums, Mike Portnoy was in Dream Theater. He teaches drums. Yeah. He's one of the best drummers in the world. And then he's playing with Twisted Sister. Then I get to see Ice Cube doing, he did a majority of NWA's first album. And then the Pixies were on after. I was like, what a day. What a day to just be. Having pints in the sun,
that's fucking fantastic. But I must tell you, when I say I seen the Pixies, I saw half the Pixies. It was in Ulster Hall. I saw half the set because I went outside into the foyer for a smoke, and with my mate, and we were leaning against a wall, and just, you know, with the stairs curl up there. There was a guy and a girl, and the two of them, they were riding each other underneath the stairs. So we just stayed and watched them.
There was no Sky TV in fucking Lurgan back then.
Well, I remember I was talking to my mate. My mate, I said, "Are you fucking listening to me?" And he went, "No." And he was looking through me, and he was looking. He said, "Look," and I turned around, and they were like, "Jesus!" So I said, "Are you going back in?" And he went, "No, I'm going to stay here for a bit."
Oh, fuck me. Do you have, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, have you any recommendations for the best live show you've ever seen? But I think you've just fucking took that.
Oh, yeah, that was it. That was it. The best live show, one of the best bands that I've ever seen, and I mean this in the set, I mean, I've seen, same as yourself, I think.
Hundreds of bands.
Hundreds, thousands of bands. And a lot of them, and most of them, very, very good. But one of the bands that blew me away was the White Stripes. The first time I've seen them, or the only time I've seen them, and
where
they played. It was in Dublin Castle, in the early noughties. And some smart bastard decided to bring over basically the whole Detroit garage scene to Ireland for a gig. Maybe they did a European tour. I don't think they did. I don't think it was a European thing. I was just think it was just that. So it was the White Stripes, the Von Bondies, the Detroit Cobras, and the Dirt Bombs were all playing the one gig in Dublin.
The Dirt Bombs, I haven't heard of them in years. So good.
Fucking Mick Collins is one of my heroes. Fucking amazing band. But my favorite band the White Stripes had just released their second album, I think. It was White Blood. They'd not long released their second. I think it was, or was it the third? White Blood Cells. It was the third one. So the Stygial had been out, and then White Blood Cells. So they were kind of the big band at the time. They were on their way up. One of the bands that was following in their wake was a band called the Von Bondies. And their first album, their second album was shite. And they split up after that. But their first album, Lack of Communication, is absolutely fucking fantastic. It's recorded in Detroit. in ghetto recorders in Detroit. Again, that's a slave note shit, right? Ghetto recorders and recorders in Detroit, and it's all live room, garage, Detroit garage sound, and it just, the album is epic. I mean, absolutely a piece of glorious rock, just glorious. And so I was excited to see them. They were my band to see, although I loved all the bands, but I was really excited about seeing them. And they all played. The Vumbondis were the main White Stripes were the headliner, and the Vumbondis were on just before the White Stripes. And the Vumbondis blew me away. And I said, oh my God, they're the best band in the world. I was now a convert. Fuck me. I don't know what it is about people like Jack White and Jimi Hendrix and fucking Mick Jagger and stars. You know what I mean? Yeah. He come onto that stage, and I'm not joking, you could feel the electricity. And like I said, I like the White Stripes, but I was a Von Bondies fan.
Yeah.
And he came onto that stage, and it was palpable. And they tore through a 60-minute set that left my jaw on the floor. And it was glorious and epic. And it was one of the most memorable things I've ever seen at a gig. And it was a festival sort of set, and it was outdoor in the courtyard of Dublin Castle. But Dublin Castle's not that big.
Yeah, no.
So you kind of had a little bit of a... It was a relatively intimate for what it was. Yeah,
that links to Jack White. What did you call the guy? Is the singer songwriter was in the Raconteurs? Brendan.
Bean. No, not Brendan.
No, not Brendan Bean. Playwright. Hang on, because here's Brendan, the thing.
I'm gonna
Google it, because what I did was I actually saw him in Dundalk. He played in the Spirit Store in Dundalk.
Yeah.
And Brendan Benson. Sorry. He has
Brendan Benson.
That beautiful bit of pop music, Cold Hands, Warm Heart, if you want to check out
a good
song.
Yeah, yeah.
He was doing, him and his wife came over to Ireland, and he wanted to do a wee tour because his family are from Cork. Like, you know, generations back, as a lot of Irish Americans do, want to come over and have a look at the old homeland. And he was doing this wee gig, and I had played in the Spirit Store previously, so I knew where the dressing rooms were, and I knew where all the bits and bobs were.
Yeah.
So I got kind of pissed, because one of my mates was driving. I got kind of pissed at this. And I went, I'm going to go say hi. And I just wandered out, and I sort of stuck my head in the door, and I went, excuse me. And he went, yeah. I went, just want to say, dude, brilliant job tonight. Really loved your stuff. And he went, come on in. And I sat and I chatted with him for about an hour, with him and his wife, and their newborn child was with them. And one of the nicest dudes I've ever met, and a real, real enigmatic, you know, front man. Just him and the guitar on stage was just really captivating.
Yeah.
And then it was like a switch went, and he was just this dude that you wanted to have a beer with. It was so so different. It was like I was talking to two different people.
It's weird. Like, I mean, I don't, maybe you project onto them a little bit, because, you know, they're supposed to be stars. And then whenever you get to talk to them, like, I'm lucky enough, our label, the Bonnevilles, we're very fortunate, because we're actually on the label that we always wanted to be on. So we got, you know, if you'd have said, what label do you, well, people did, what label would you, well, we'd pick Alive Natural Science, that's where we want to go. But we never thought it would happen. But it did happen, because we got to play festivals with bands on the label. And then they liked us. And they said, you should send your stuff over to Alive in California. And that was how that happened. But I remember, you know, meeting those guys. I've been listening to like James Legg and the Left Lane Cruiser, and, you know, all the bands that are on Alive. I've been listening to them from before, back when James Legg was in the Black Diamond Heavies, 20 years, 15, 16, 18 years ago. And James Legg is the epitome of a rock star to look at, but he's the fucking nicest man I've ever met.
Yeah.
He's an absolute sweetheart in every sense of the word. And he looks like a fucking, he looks like a gunfighter from the old West. You know, he wears cowboy hats, and he dresses in a suit and cowboy boots. We toured with him. We went on tour, and we did a double headliner tour with him, and it was he's sitting there helping you hump your gear in out of the van, and you're like, you know.
Is it well, two questions for this about what you're going to do with the band and or what you've been doing. Does it bring you kind of great degree of humanity? Because people say don't meet your heroes, but this is somebody you've been listening to for 20 years, and now you're on tour with them. Is it weird that had you projected an image of what you thought it was going to be, and then you're like, just some dudes that like playing guitar?
Yeah, probably a little bit. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not a child. If you get on like a dick, I'm going to call him a dick. But I'm also not a child in the sense that if he was a dick, I'm still going to like his music because it's good.
Yeah, that's true. And the Sorry, finish your point, Danny.
That's it. Go on ahead. Yep.
Well, the second part I wanted to say before we switch off the music part of the thing is bringing you right back to the Bonnevilles and what you're doing. So you're producing your own solo stuff. When you produce solo stuff, this is a side question because I'm a pain in the hole. Is it stuff that you think won't suit the band, the aesthetic or the sound, or is it just a more personal thing?
Yeah, it's not Bonneville stuff. It can't be. Yeah. If there's anything I write that sounds like it could go on a Bonneville's album, it goes on to a Bonneville's album. You know, there's no point in me doing a one man Bonneville's. You know, that's stupid.
Yeah.
You know, the Bonnevilles is what we've worked on and what we've built up and what has the traction. So there's no point in me thinking, oh, that's a good song, I'll keep it for myself.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And then secondly, with the sort of obviously the two of us being romantics for music, would the dream be to be, do you want to be a massive band, or would you be happy to, because I always say when I was playing music, when we played a really nice club show, I said I'd be happy to do that the rest of my days. If I could be sustainable and not have to worry about paying the mortgage and stuff, if I could do that and do a tour a year, I would be fucking happy to get into a dirty, sweaty club and be on stage doing what I used to love when I was a teenager, which was watching bands do that. Would you be happy to be sustainable as opposed to the biggest band in the world?
Completely. That was always the goal was always to be a working musician. That was always the intention. And we, you know, the Bonnevilles, there's only so much we can actually do because Chris, you know, he has a young family now and he does have, he has another job and everything. And but they're very good. I must say now they've been absolutely brilliant. Like we've never had any issues with taking time off, and Chris has never had any issues with taking time off. So, but we could do that. We've got that. That groundwork done that we could go full time on the road, no problem. We could, but you know, Chris has a career and everything, and you know, and we could do that. So, I remember that, like, you probably know what this feels like. The first time you play the Limelight.
First time I played the Limelight, I opened up for the Dwarves. That was the first time I played the Limelight.
Well, there you go. We played with the Dwarves there last year.
Yeah.
And so the first time you play the Limelight, you go, oh my God, I'm now playing the same stage that I watched bands playing growing up. And then you realize, well, they made a living doing it. So then you go, well, if I can fill, Chris and I have these conversations regularly. If we can fill a Limelight every night that we go out, wherever it is in the world, this is now a 50 grand a year job.
Yeah.
But the reality is, back to your very first question, Tuesday night's a toilet with 20 people, you know, and that's just the reality. So what happens is the Saturday night big gig, the Friday night big gig often goes to supplement the Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, not big gig.
Yeah.
You know, or pay for the fuel for the rest of the week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you have a stormer in front of 15 people, you might sell 10 albums. And sometimes merch-wise, I've seen that sometimes merch-wise, a gig of 20 people is more profitable than playing to 300 people who have a great time but just aren't interested in a new t-shirt.
Absolutely, mate. It's so true. And it's one of the things that we've always done. Again, this is something I learned from the American bands as well, funnily enough. Those same bands that I mentioned earlier on, I always noticed that like Irish bands, we never had any merch. I'm not talking about the Dangerfields now, I'm talking about the bands that I was hanging out with. We never had merch. We were almost embarrassed to try and sell stuff. It was almost...
I think it's the Irish tall poppy syndrome. You don't want to...
Yeah.
You don't want to out yourself.
Exactly. But when I'm going up to, back in the day, like I've seen in Aunt Annie's, I've seen the sites, I've seen the Von Bondies in Aunt Annie's and lots of others. Little small venue. And the fucking lead singer of the band's on the merch stand at the front door. And this blew me away. I literally couldn't believe that. And whenever I'm going out, all four members of the band are on the merch. All of them. And I went, right, we have to get the merch. We have to sort the merch out. And then that then leads into the whole vinyl thing because of the collectability and the you know, the desirability of vinyl, that you'll buy the vinyl. Like, people buy vinyl, don't even own fucking record players.
That's madness.
I know. Imagine that owning a record player.
Yeah. It's so mad as well how in vogue it is, because people had vinyl, threw away their vinyl, replaced the same albums on CD, and now they're back buying it on vinyl. And they might have fucked out a version of it that when it was the original release, which is probably worth 200 quid now.
Exactly. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. It's actually shocking. It is shocking.
It's mad as well, because now a CD is fucking £4, and a vinyl, which is something that's been in existence since the 19th century, is now £24 if you want a new album.
Yeah, exactly. But that's as long as, I mean, I know I heard of tapes. There was a rumbling there, you know, for a long while. The hipsters have been trying to get tapes to come back, and I hope they don't. I fucking hated tapes. They always broke.
Sound quality's bollocks as well.
And you always ended up buying the same. I mean, I think I bought the Beatles live at the Hollywood Bowl about 8 times. And I just got the, I mean, I was listening to it. It was a favourite album of mine for quite a while. And the last copy broke, and I went, I'm not paying for this again. I'm not buying this. You know, Paul McCartney's had enough of my money.
What I will do is I will leave you with I'm sorry to be a pain in the arse. I want to keep you on to talk about something else. But before we leave the music thing, there's a guy called Gary McParland, who's a guy from Bessbrook, where I'm from. He's the older brother of one of my mates, a guy called Colin McParland. Gary told me about this amazing scam he was running in Newry Library and Bessbrook Library back in the 80s. Big metaler. Whenever Metallica and Pantera and bands were releasing albums, here's the scam. You nip into the local library. So, folks, if you're listening, if tapes ever come back and hipsters want to save a few pound, here's what you do. Go into the library, get them to order the tape for you. So he would get the tape ordered in, let's say Metallica Master of Puppets, gets the tape, rents it out, takes it home, tapes it onto a TDK 90. Yeah. And then he said, I got so bold from recording the albums and taping them when I had them, sometimes he left back the copy. He didn't leave them back the original tape. He has an original tape of Pantera, Cowboys from Hell, and a couple of other albums that he got free from Newry Library.
Newry Library
stamped on them.
Yeah, exactly. So it was him, the bastard.
Hang on, to be fair now, Metallica got famous because Lars Ulrich was in a tape trading scheme where he would send bands out to this, so he can't be fucking saying nothing about piracy, you know what I mean?
There you go.
Oh, Jesus. But Annie, before we take you off this part of the podcast, because I want to, I'm going to pause this so we can have a wee and grab a beer. But
yeah,
if we want to help you as a band and as a full-time musician, where do we buy the Bonneville's merch? Where do we find you? Because I'm going to get myself a sweet wee Bonneville's t-shirt after this. So.
Oh, nice one. Thank you very much for asking. It's thebonnevilles.co.uk.
Okay, and that's everything we need.
That's it. Everything, all our links and our store and our social media is all on that.
Cool. And remember, black t-shirts look good on everybody. So get yourself a Bonneville's t-shirt. And if you've got a sweet top knot and you smoke a vape, there's vinyl on sale as well. All right, all you hipsters, I hope you've enjoyed this portion. Andy, before I hijack you, because I've already had you for an hour, do you have a half hour for me? Or I know you're trying to edit something.
Yeah, no.
Because right, I want to talk about your podcast, but I feel I can do that as a separate entity, if that's
cool.
Possible.
That's absolutely. Let's do it. Yeah.
Brilliant, folks. We're going to take. You can take as long as a break as you want. Me and Andy are going to take a 2-minute break while I go and get this organized. Andy, I'll be straight back to you, okay? So stick around. Folks, check out thebonnevilles.co.uk. If you're into your music, if you want to support a local artist and a local musician, because I don't know if you've ever been to Lurgan, but fuck me, then people need money. So get on and get supporting, and I'll be right back in 5 minutes with part two of this lovely podcast of Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends. Bonnevilles.co.uk. Go listen to some fucking rock and roll and dirty blues.